In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about Iraq and about American policy toward Iraq. And our guest with this program, a gentleman who is arguably the leading, if not one of the leading, critics of American policy toward Iraq in this country. His name is Ramsey Clark. He served for a couple of years between 1967 and 1969 as Attorney General of the United States. And in 1992, he and some others formed an organization called the International Action Center, formed that in order to call attention to the effects on the people of Iraq of the bombing of that country. And since, they have also been involved in some other issues as well, as a leader in the movement to end sanctions on Iraq. They were opposed to the expansion of NATO bombing of Serbs in Bosnia. They would like to see an end to the blockade of Cuba. They have a fairly broad human rights agenda. He is here on the campus to talk about Iraq, and we'll be giving a couple of public talks. He'll be speaking at noon today at the Courtyard Cafe at the Student Union on the campus. And then after that, the discussion will move to Illini Rooms A and B beginning at 1. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you're interested in hearing more from the guest, you're welcome to attend. And, of course, as we talk here, anyone listening is welcome to call. We ask only of callers that they try to keep their comments brief just so we can keep our program moving along and accommodate as many different people as would like to call. Anyone is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, and locally, 333-9455, or WILL, same either way. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's good to be with you. You've got a beautiful building and studio here, so it's nice to see such a fine facility on a campus.
Well, we're very proud of it. The organization, the International Action Center, now, as I said, does indeed have a fairly broad sort of human rights agenda, a lot of things that you're interested in, but it was Iraq that got this organization started. Why that? I mean, what was it about that issue that led you to feel that it was something that needed particular attention that you wanted to call people's attention to?
Well, actually, the people who first organized International Action Center had been working on other issues for some time together, informally. We'd done a lot of work on the 1989 invasion of Panama, and done work on the age-old embargo against Cuba. But I think direct involvement with first the effort to prevent an assault on Iraq and then presence in Iraq. I went there on February the 2nd, at the end of the second week of the bombing, and stayed for this third and fourth week of what was only 7 weeks of 6 weeks of bombing. So we had a pretty intense feeling of the horror of what was happening and the effect of the sanctions even then. The Red Crescent told me in February of 91, during the bombing, that already they thought 6,000 children had died as a direct result of the sanctions. Mm-hmm. So that caused us to organize a little more formally, and our first major and continuing project, tragically, because it's still going on, is Iraq, and primarily the sanctions against Iraq now.
You were there just recently, in I believe in January,
yes.
Which had been the latest in a number of trips that you had made there to assess conditions in the country, particularly related to the sanctions, which have been going on now for more than 9 years. What did you find there when you went?
It's always heartbreaking to go to Iraq under the sanctions because of the desperate conditions of the people. It's also inspiring to see their courage and their determination, particularly people in the healthcare field, how they stand it. I don't know. Every doctor or nurse will tell you that they lose patients constantly, every day, that they could save easily with simple medications or simple therapies that aren't available. This was my 10th trip to Iraq since the sanctions were imposed first on Hiroshima Day of 1990, August the 6th. The main thing that was reaffirmed is that the terrible death rate is continuing. I've got some statistics that are, I think, important to observe that tell the story graphically. The victims of sanctions, which mean that you're not getting food, you're not getting medicine, you're not getting essentials for life, are naturally the weakest, most vulnerable people in the society. So the principal victims of sanctions are infants who are fragile, little children who are going through a shakedown cruise to see how tough they are and whether they make it, elderly people who are waning into a weakened condition, and chronically ill people who need insulin, who need dialysis, who need something constantly, or they die. But just looking at the children, what we found on this 9th anniversary of the beginning of the bombing, which we were there for, was that the death rates of children under 5 continued to escalate radically. In 1989, which was the last full year before sanctions, the numbers of children that died from the three principal causes of infant mortality of live births, there were 7,110 recorded deaths of children under 5. In 1991, which is the first full year under the sanctions, that had nearly quadrupled to 27,000. It's gone up radically every year. The first full year under the Food for Oil program, which is supposed to relieve the horrible death rates and sickness and physical injuries of the sanctions, there were, this is 1997, there were 58,800 deaths of children under 5, remembering that we came from a base of 7,100. The next year, 1998, the second year under the second full year under Food for Oil, 71,000, up from 58,000 to 71,000. The first 11 months of 1999, there were 73,000, and there were more than 7,000 in December, which is usually a bad month anyway, which means more than 80,000 children. That's well over 10 times the number of children under 5 who were dying before the sanctions. And that's only a minor part of the total physical devastation of the population.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but I want to talk about the Oil for Food program that the United Nations came up with. The deal was that Iraq was going to be allowed to sell $10 billion worth of oil every year and then use the proceeds to buy things like medicine and food to provide for the basic needs of the Iraqi people. Why, assuming that you would say that this program hasn't been successful, why has it not worked? One might argue that $10 billion wasn't enough, but it's a significant amount of money, and one would think that that would help to ease the suffering of the people of Iraq. Why has that not done that?
Frankly, I think it was Caloric intake in Iraq was quite high. It was about 3,400 calories per day per adult person. And the government was spending about $20 billion in the service, social, food sector. Iraq was importing more than half of its food, as most Arab countries have done for some time, particularly the oil-rich Arab countries. So there's their food distribution, food subsidy programs. So you can see immediately that 10 million is only half. But in addition, while the program promised 10 million, and contracts have been per year, and it's been now 3 years, and contracts have been proffered for about 30 billion, Iraq has actually received under 6 billion. The U.S. and the UN have taken more than $9 billion, both for what they call reparations and damages, and to manage the programs which are strangling Iraq. So you're paying. It's first, it's tribute. We remember we used to say millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. And second, you're paying the enemy, so to speak. You're financing the very people who are strangling you. Now, if you look at the less than $6 billion that's come through in 3 years, it's averaged under $2 billion a year, which is less than 10% of what you were paying. But if you looked at vital things like water, Iraq's water system was absolutely devastated, and bad water has been one of the principal causes of death. Little babies will dehydrate quickly if they have diarrhea and vomiting. They can go in a matter of a day or so, and you don't have any rehydration tablets. You've got to have good water. They had contracted for more than $700 million for water purification. They won't get chlorine, absolutely no chlorine. Most cities in the United States use chlorine customarily in the water. They can't get chlorine. The UN refuses to approve chlorine. The U.S. can veto it by itself. No chlorine for Iraq. They've gotten less than 9%, about $65 million out of the $700 million they sought. The amount of food that they've gotten has been approved at a rate of just under 70%. And their daily caloric intake from all ration food, and they have the government has a monopoly on the basic staples, and they distribute it equally to every person in the country, rich and poor, and alien and citizen, and Muslim and Christian and atheist, if there are any, and the rest. Everybody gets 1,100 calories. So what you see is a continuing deficiency. Now, these years are building on years of severe privation. The kids have had amoebic dysentery. The adults have had tuberculosis, and diabetes is destroying them, and still malnutrition, and still inadequate medicine. You go into the hospitals, and they're absolutely disastrous. It's just heartbreaking to see them. I mean, the pharmacies are empty, and they don't have linens at all. You bring in your own linens. They don't have antiseptics. They don't have anesthesias. They don't have catheters. They don't have clean water. So it'll take many billions. You see that in spite of 3 years of food for oil, and the UN has to approve each contract, and it delivers each purchase into the country, and it monitors its distribution. So there's no cheating on the thing. You can't convert rice from Vietnam, where most of the rice is coming from, into bullets or into something else. So it's simply not enough. The death rates have continued to skyrocket. As I mentioned earlier, the first full year, the number of deaths under children under five was 58,000, and last year it was 80,000.
But let me at this point, I probably should introduce you again to people who might have tuned in the last 5 minutes or so. We're talking this morning with Ramsey Clark, He is one of the founders and chair of the International Action Center, which is based in New York, a human rights organization that is concerned about a number of issues. And one of those that really got it going formally as an organization was the Iraq War. And they have been very concerned since that time of the effects of bombing on the people of Iraq and also of the continued UN sanctions against Iraq. And they are concerned with other issues as well. That's just one of them. They do, by the way, have a website, so if you're interested in seeing something of what their organization is all about, you can do that. Check it out. And, of course, call in here if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to raise a question that I'm sure that will some people would ask if they had the opportunity, and that is they would argue that the one person who is in the best position to ease the suffering of the people of Iraq is Saddam Hussein, and that if all that he would have to do would be to abide by the agreement that had been reached between the government of Iraq and the United Nations after the Gulf War to allow for inspections in Iraq to make the determination that Iraq does not have weapons of mass destruction, and if that happened, the sanctions would be lifted, and that this is something that the government of Iraq has never fully complied with, and that if they did, they wouldn't have the problems that you have talked about.
Well, the short answer is that you can't kill children because you don't like what a political leader does or doesn't do. You can't make the elderly and the chronically ill and the children the victims of your conduct because Saddam Hussein or anybody else doesn't do what you demand. The cause of the deaths is you're depriving the people of food and medicine. The Geneva Conventions prohibit the use of starvation as a weapon of war. We're using it as a weapon of peace and coercion. The Geneva Conventions require you to give medicine and medical care to an enemy soldier who was shooting at you 30 seconds ago, if you can safely do so. I mean, you don't have to run out of your foxhole and get him, but if you're in a position and you have the medicine and you can administer it to him, you are obligated as a matter of law, and it's a war crime not to do it. And here we're depriving infants and children and pregnant women and elderly people and diabetics and others of essential medicines. So Saddam Hussein could commit suicide. He could do anything, but we're responsible for what we do. Mm-hmm. And we are the ones that are imposing these sanctions. We're the ones that have used sanctions internationally consistently around the world. More than 70% of all the sanctions used since World War II have been U.S. sanctions, and most of them have been unilateral. And if you look at Cuba, and you'll see how incredibly out of touch with the feelings of the world what we do. You got 11 million Cubans. We have reduced their daily caloric intake by about 50%. You think about that all day long, you know, because your stomach is growling. It's mm-hmm. empty. You're hungry. People are doing this to you. 11 million people, collective punishment, because we don't like. You say, well, Castro could end all that. You know, he could get in a boat and try to get to Key West and drown. But we're the ones that are imposing the blockade. The UN resolved, the General Assembly had a resolution to condemn the United States for its unilateral sanction on Cuba. It's had it every year for years. The last two votes is an illustration of world opinion. 157 countries voted to condemn the United States for its sanctions, its blockade, as they call it, bloqueo, against Cuba, to two who oppose that condemnation. So you can demonize someone all you want to, but you cannot escape the responsibility for the consequences of your own acts. And these sanctions are the acts of the United States. Even in the permanent representation on the Security Council, only the United Kingdom joins the United States in favoring these sanctions. France and the Russian Federation, People's Republic of China oppose it. Most poor countries oppose it because they realize that they're victims of sanctions in other ways as their economies deteriorate and their people hunger.
Some people have argued that the sanctions against Iraq have certainly been imperfect and leaky, and that for some time now Iraq has been smuggling oil out of the country by loading it onto ships and moving in Iranian waters to try to insulate those ships from being inspected and boarded by Americans, as just recently happened with a Soviet tanker that was found to have Iraqi oil in it. It was, according to a story that appeared fairly recently in the New York Times, this has been happening more and more recently, and they quote American intelligence estimates that say just in the month of December alone, Iraq smuggled out over 300,000 metric tons of oil. At today's price, they say that's $62 million worth. That's just in the month of December. That would suggest that the government of Iraq has significant resources that they could draw on, aside from the fact that there are sanctions, aside from the fact that maybe the Food for All program doesn't work, and that they've got the money, and that if they're not spending it to take care of their people, that's not U.S. sanctions. That's a government that is interested in prolonging the suffering of its people because it makes the U.S. and the U.N. and its allies look bad.
Yeah, but that argument overlooks the obvious truth of the matter. It implies that the sanctions have no effect, that they've got plenty of money. Then why have the sanctions, you know? That doesn't make any sense, does it? The fact is that the amount of oil that is smuggled, if it's as high as they claim, is still insignificant. It's a minor fraction of the food for oil quantities, which we've just demonstrated were less than 10% of what was being expended earlier when everything wasn't in a state of collapse and disrepair. But before we get too horrified about smuggling oil, we could ask two questions. If your children were sick or hungry, would you just sit there? Or would you try to do something? Would you try to get some food and medicine? Would you smuggle a little of your own oil? It's not like you're stealing somebody's oil. It's your own oil. Who says you can't sell it and why? What we ignore is that the sanctions are a crime against humanity in the Nuremberg sense, that they deliberately inflict collective punishment on a whole nation. And as a lawyer who's worked for years on the Genocide Convention, I've worked for years trying to get the United States to ratify the Genocide Convention. I went to the American Bar Association convention for about 15 years for no other purpose than to urge the American Bar Association as a legal group to say, look, let's abide by international law. Are we against genocide or are we for it? But the sanctions are genocide. Here's what the Genocide Convention says. Genocide, this is Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, means any of the following acts: deliberately inflicting on a group in whole or in part with intent to destroy because of its nationality, its ethnicity, its race, or religion, conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Well, if that's not what the sanctions are calculated to do intentionally and deliberately, what else? And so now there's oil dribbling and you're going to worry about it? You can only enforce sanctions by power if we didn't have the largest naval armada since World War II in the Gulf. We couldn't stop the Russian tanker, could we? We couldn't prevent the oil from coming out. It has to be done by force. You have to have superior force, and you've got to punish people who violate it by buying or selling. But the fact remains that the sanctions and, you know, oil prices internationally reflect it, and everybody knows it, have prevented Iraq from participating in the international economy by the sale of its oil, which was its principal source of income, and it has caused this devastating condition on the people, and it has prevented them from having essentials of life in violation of the Geneva Conventions, including food and medicine. Mm.
The United States government is on the record, clearly on the record, saying, Secretary of State has said it, not certainly the president himself has said it, but the government has said it, that they want to see a change of government in Iraq. It's very clear. I'm sure no one would ever go on the record as saying that the sanctions, putting pressure on the people, is part of a strategy to either to have them rise up and replace their government or something else. But do you think that that is indeed a deliberate move on the part of the government, that that's part of the thinking of the government?
Well, it's not only inhumane if it is. what you're saying is you punish everybody until they can't stand anymore and they uprise and overthrow their government. But it's out of touch with reality. The reality is known to everyone who thinks and to anyone who can go there and see, and that is that the sanctions have unified the people of Iraq as very few things could. They see their government as their principal means of support. Poor people get virtually all of their food from their government. They get all of their health care, pitiful as it is, inadequate as it is, from their government. They see the United States is depriving them of the 3,400 calories they got a day before the sanctions instead of the 1,100 they're getting now, and the fact that their baby just died because it didn't have a rehydration tablet that wouldn't have cost 2 cents because the United States sanctioned. So it necessarily, in terms of human nature, unifies the people, and they are unified as they've never been before. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that in the Kurdish areas where we've blocked off areas and where we're financing rival groups that there's not hostility and all, but the people of Iraq are driven to support their government as their real lifeline.
Caller here on line one in Champaign County. Hello.
The oil for peace, or the oil for food deal that you referred to earlier, and we have it from the 34 veteran of the United Nations, the Irishman Dennis Halliday, who resigned and is now speaking out against the sanctions, that it isn't possibly going to work. Even if it was totally successful, it would provide, I think, 25 cents a day per capita. The other thing is that there seems to be a pattern of what items are not verified. You mentioned chlorine not being allowed through, but it's been asserted that there's a pattern of even in medical supplies of leaving out sort of pivotal items. That it seems that it's quite a facade. And I think you worked with Voices in the Wilderness. I understand who've been symbolically violating the sanctions. And then just recently, you helped load school supplies. I'd like for you to tell people what our government is defining as sanctionable items. Thank you very much.
Well, it's nice to hear you, nice to know of how well-informed you are and people are becoming, I hope. Dennis Halliday is a hero. We shouldn't ignore that. He's one of the few people we've seen recently who's resigned from office in a career-damaging way because he couldn't stand to do something as wrong as manage, as he and he was the principal manager for the Food for Oil program, and he could see it was just a means of not prolonging, actually, but worsening the tragic condition of the Iraqi people. It's quite incredible to examine the medicines and items that are excluded. Vehicles in Iraq generally are in a state of disrepair. 80% of the former sanitation garbage type trucks are out of business. There's a lot of garbage laying around, needless to say. No ambulances. Not an ambulance. Sometimes you need an ambulance pretty bad, and you can't get one anyplace in Iraq. They had a contract for ambulances, and it was rejected. No ambulances. They claimed somehow or other they had dual use. They could use them for tanks or something, I guess. And so they get no ambulance. One of the most remarkable achievements of medical science has been its vaccinations of common communicable diseases for children. And we've had for some years now single shots inoculations that can take care of 5 or 6, depending on the combinations that you put in, different diseases. And a lot of them are fatal and a lot more damaging permanently to children. Most children in rich countries, virtually all children, get them. They've saved tens of millions of lives internationally by just campaigns to go in and inoculate every child. You can't get those inoculations in Iraq. Can you imagine that? For measles and chicken pox and whooping cough and mumps and things like that. You just don't get them. The kids are going to have it, and too bad, and hope they'll enjoy it. Some strategic things that you can't get are sutures. The amount of surgery in the country is down to about 22% what it was before the war. Only emergency cases, anything that can be put off, you put off. And you might be able to get, for a particular surgery, most of the stuff you need, but you don't have sutures. Well, you know, if you open that person up, you better be prepared to sew them back together. Otherwise, you're going to have a problem. It's that sort of thing that's been done time and time again. Voices in the Wilderness has gone in heroically time and time again, and we've gone in with them many times. They're wonderful people. They defy the blockade, so to speak. We do too. Our biggest medical shipment, we carried it in. I came in that time from Syria, just to show that Syrian government would be willing to let a big truckload. And I'll tell you, the truck that said medicine for Iraq would drive down the street of Damascus and elsewhere in Syria, and people were first surprised to see it, and then they would cheer. I mean, you're just driving down the street and people are cheering. And this is, of course, it was in Arabic as well as English, but we took in that time something over $5 million worth of medicine, which pitifully small in a way, but it was a contribution of many, many American people who just wanted to try to give something. They might save a child. They might help. This time, in January of this year, just a couple of weeks ago, we took in medicine primarily for tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was pretty well controlled and eliminated. Now it's rising from all kinds of conditions. It'll be years and years before you get control back on tuberculosis, so they need a lot of medicine. We took in about $2 million for tuberculosis and $1 million more of other special items that they particularly needed. And folks are doing that more and more. As you can see, though, it's woefully inadequate. It helps. Every little bit helps, but it's a minor fraction of even the Food for Oil program, which is woefully inadequate. It's the only way. One of the tragedies is that there is terrible suffering all over the world, and in most situations, the people can't really help themselves. They're in war, they're in famine, they're in drought, and they're desperately poor. Iraq was able to provide. It is able to provide. It is deliberately prevented from providing, as a direct policy of the United States government, and it's killing their people and stunting those who survive. There's a stunted generation, underdeveloped, small. Just to watch the below healthy birth weight statistics is heartbreaking. In 1989, less than 5%, about 4.5% of the infants born live were at birth weights below 2.5 kilos. Now, to be born below 2.5 kilos means a lot of things. You've probably seen some of the articles in the paper recently about how they don't perform well in school. They're underdeveloped. They're higher percentages, much higher retardation, things like that. But there are also organs that didn't develop. They don't work well, including the heart and the liver and whatever it is. That has gone up every year until now. One child, one infant in four born in Iraq is 24.5% are born under 2.5 kilos. Now, that doesn't mean all the rest are good, healthy babies, because all the rest are affected too, or at least 95% of the rest are affected. That's why you have a stunted generation. That's what we're doing to those people with these sanctions, and it's one of the great crimes of our history.
Sir, I did get a chance to look at your latest document, and the figures about water are amazing. The amount of rebuilding that needs to be done, that this goes back the 9 years, and not just water for drinking, but I guess the irrigation system was bombed at the very beginning, too, and this is in a desert climate, obviously. It's a myriad, it's encyclopedic, the things that could be spoken of, but the one point that I did ask in the prior question was that I believe that you broke the blockade with pencils. Is this the case?
We took in a couple of million pencils. They were happily, we took some from here, but they were happily provided overwhelmingly by the people of Jordan and by the school children of Jordan. I'll tell you what you see, it's unbelievable. In these huge garbage piles in the cities, you see children and goats scrambling to find paper because there's no paper for the children. You can't learn to write if you don't have something to write on. You don't have a pencil. You don't have professors and college students don't have pencils. You know, you don't think of not having a pencil. Nothing to write with. You can't get them in through the sanctions because they think, well, there's graphite in there, so whatever it is, you might make a bomb out of a pencil, you know. So we took in a whole lot of pencils, and it created a lot of joy, and they'll probably last for 6 months, maybe not quite that long.
We have just about 10 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have another caller here, and I want to get them in. And then also, one more time again, I think I should introduce our guest. We're talking with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He is one of the founders and chair of the International Action Center based in New York City, an organization that, among other things, has been working to try to call people's attention to the effects that sanctions against Iraq have had on the people of Iraq. He'll be speaking, by the way, on the U of I campus today. And again, one more time before the end, I'll tell you where you can go to hear the talk. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL, if you'd like to call in. Here's another caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. It's good to hear Ramsey Clark. I have a short question and then maybe an off-the-wall question, I don't know. But the short question is, do you see much difference, or do you see mostly similarities between the situation in Iraq and the Cuban situation? And then my second question was, I'll let you answer that first.
The major difference, and I don't mean to diminish the suffering of the Cuban people, is the severity of the sanctions against Iraq. They are the most severe sanctions ever imposed on an entire nation and maintained for such a lengthy period of time, and they affect every aspect of life for everybody, every moment of every day. Cuba's sanctions or blockade is is the United States alone. We try to prevent other people from doing business with them, but Canada and France and Spain and others do a lot of business. They've suffered terribly in large part because with the collapse of Eastern Bloc countries, they lost most of their trading partners, and they've had to reestablish trade and all, but they're an industrious people, and they're coming back although the dominant fact in their lives, and it'll remain so if the blockade ended today, will be this long period of privation forced by their good neighbor to the north. You don't have anything like the death rates. There was that terrible moment when they were having mysterious blindness, you remember, and we went down with a bunch of doctors from New York and elsewhere, ophthalmologists and oculists and others that would know about sight, also some medical historians, and pretty soon found that they didn't know what the cause was. They thought it might be an insecticide. Some of the first cases were young men working in tobacco fields, and they were having first thousands and then tens of thousands of young people going blind. And what they finally detected was that they had an agricultural revolution going on because they had to produce more food. So office workers and others who were used to hard work and young, strong people were getting less rations because they were stronger and they didn't need as much rations. And suddenly they were having to bicycle out because they didn't have gasoline to go in a vehicle or didn't have a vehicle that would take them out to fields. And they were working in the heat and they were bicycling back in. And slowly there was a huge vitamin B deficiency accumulating, and they were losing eyesight. When they once figured it out, they flew in literally millions. I remember the first plane load had about 35 million vitamin B tablets. And they distributed them all over the country and said, everybody take three today and we'll get you some more as soon as we can. And they stopped it after it reached about 75,000 people. It was terrifying. The only other historical episodes like that were prisoners of war camp in hot climates during World War II, where the prisoners were made to work hard on meager rations, and they had this same phenomenon occur. And that's where it was really discovered what the cause was.
I didn't mean to sidetrack your talk, but then I got this is a second question. Perhaps you can blow off. It might be too off the wall. But I was reading in the newspaper that the FBI divulged they had a 33-page dossier on John Denver, which I thought was pretty laughable, you know. And then because he was kind of like a peacenik, and it suddenly occurred to me, why is it that nobody questions the FBI investigating people who are for peace, and yet, to my knowledge, they do not investigate people who are pro-war? And I was kind of curious if you had any kind of insight into that.
Well, the logic of it is that they're against peace and for war. They investigate for security purposes people that go into classified work in the military establishment, but that's just to assure their purity, their willingness absolutely to obey authority, whatever the command. We ought to face up to the fact that we have real problems with our law enforcement. It's excessive use of violence. I'm struggling in the Waco case now, and it's just heartbreaking to see how they cover up, and they don't they just don't tell you what you do. When you realize 33 pages is a fairly small dossier, but John Denver, isn't that outrageous? What kind of free society is that, you know?
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I want to try to get at least one more. We'll go to Champaign here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mr. Clark, you may have mentioned this. I tuned in a little late, but I'm interested in knowing one of the arguments that I was surprised not to have heard you make against the sanctions was that Saddam and his cronies and his family are actually getting rich off of them. Is there anything to that argument?
I don't think there is. It's a hard way to get rich, isn't it? I mean, the more money.
With the smuggling.
The smuggling? No,
yeah.
The smuggling is pretty small-time stuff. If you can sell $35 billion worth of oil, why do you want to smuggle $50 million, It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? The fact is that when you smuggle oil, you get the lowest price on the market, don't you? And the highest cost and the highest risk. It's not a high profit.
I'm not sure oil is what I'm referring to here. I'm not sure what all of the commodities are. It may actually be finished oil products coming into Iraq and other kinds of products as well that are that are prohibited from the sanctions but are still important to the society?
Well, the more money the society has, the more money you can steal. It just doesn't, it's not good arithmetic to think that anybody's, it doesn't mean that they may not be privateers. The food system's been checked out. It's monitored constantly by the UN. I've watched it. It's the fairest, most effective food distribution system I've ever seen. I go back to rationing here in World War II. I remember people cheating on sugar and coffee and gasoline and shoes and stuff like that. You don't find that cheating over there because everybody knows, everybody depends on what they're getting, and they have to have it. I don't see a profit motive as making any sense. What I see is the United States throwing up every propaganda item. They'll say he's got a new yacht on the Euphrates. There are no yachts on the Euphrates, you know. There haven't been yachts on the Euphrates in a long time. Well, I'll guarantee you one thing. If Saddam Hussein had a yacht and it was on the Euphrates, he'd never set foot on it because he remembers how they tried to hit him with a Tomahawk cruise missile in the Al-Rashid Hotel and elsewhere. It'd be the last thing in the world. It makes absolutely no sense. These are foolish arguments that are cruel because they know that they continue the causes that are killing children.
Okay, thank you.
All right. The what you have argued, made the argument that it is unjust to inflict suffering on the people of Iraq because we don't like their government. If we should lift the sanctions against Iraq, some people would say we still face a fundamental problem, that we have a leader of a country that clearly is a threat to his region, has demonstrated his belligerence against his neighbors, has demonstrated an interest in developing weapons of mass destruction. So then the question is, what do we do about that, if indeed we should do anything about it?
Well, I don't think that it's for us to determine who heads governments of the world. If you look at our record, we substituted democratically elected Mossadegh with the Shah of Iran, didn't we, 25 years of tyranny. The first prime minister elected in a free Congo was Patrice Lumumba. In 1962, his body was found in the trunk of a CIA car. And Mobutu reigned in Congo from 62 until 2 years ago, an absolute reign of terror. Pinochet in Chile, being pursued somewhat now for his human rights violations, was our man in Santiago. We participated in the overthrow of Allende. Arbenz in Guatemala. Are we the ones that are going to determine who heads these governments? But what we have to realize is that if the sanctions were off, we wouldn't be responsible, because we are responsible for the acts of our government, for 80,000 deaths of children under five next year. I would hope Americans would feel a little better about themselves if they didn't have that responsibility. But there must be some accountability for what we have done. 1.5 million Iraqi people have died because of these sanctions, and they are criminal.
Well, at that, we're going to have to close. I do want to mention again, however, our guest, Ramsey Clark, will be speaking today on the U of I campus at the Courtyard Cafe at noontime. That's in the Illini Union. And then after that, the discussion continues in Illini Rooms A and B at 1. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here.